When's the Hendrix retirement? Do you have the Hendrix retirement on your... I just screwed
up.
Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order belatedly. We had both freeway bridges frozen or closed because of ice this morning, so my chauffeur was not able to get to me in time. Anyway, we have our forecast today, but Dr. Warner wanted to say something before we got started.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is something highly technical. Remind you to refresh your screens because we're just going to release this to the public. So go ahead and refresh your screens, and then you'll be able to see it on your OLIS.
Okay.
The presentation will be on the screen.
Since I'm completely flying blind, since my computer isn't here, let's just call up the troops and get going.
4 o'clock.
Okay. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark McMullen. I'm the state economist with the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis, joined this morning by my colleague, Josh Lehner. Now, Oregon's economic expansion is clearly getting stronger. We saw in the first 4 months of fiscal year 2014, we've seen personal income taxes that are taken out of paychecks are growing at twice the rate that they were in fiscal year 2013. The improvement in our economic growth is really not generated by any one driver or any silver bullet. The reason we are doing better is because expansion is becoming more broad-based. It's spreading out both throughout industries and across regions of the state, which has been long overdue, but we're finally starting to see some of our rural areas improve and, in fact, do better than some of our urban areas in the last few months. Now, unfortunately, while the economic expansion is getting stronger, we've been banking on this for some time, and so there really isn't a significant increase in the revenue forecast. The revenue forecast is roughly unchanged, fundamentally down slightly from 3 months ago, if not abstracting away from the revenue changes in the special session that were made. So while we're not going to get a whole lot while we're not going to get extra revenue from this growth because it was expected and baked in the cake, it's certainly a good thing. It will mean that there'll be less need for government services. The spreading out to rural areas is particularly favorable in terms of that. And we're also going to see some local governments are starting to report better budget situations there. They depend on the property taxes, and some relatively modest and conservative forecasts are now getting outperformed. And so a lot of our local governments are going to start to see a little bit of budget relief going forward. Mm-hmm. So while we've really banked on this acceleration to date, and we're not calling for a significant change in the revenue outlook at this time, there is quite a bit of upside risk. In our baseline outlook, this growth rate that we're seeing now is really about as good as it gets. And we hold this sort of pace for another half year or two and then modestly slow down throughout the outlook. So there is now a significant chance that we could do better than this. There's quite a bit of upside risk out there. The housing market isn't all the way back yet, so there's still some growth that could happen there. Again, in terms of our regional areas, we still have some areas of the state that haven't come online yet, even though some are, and that could improve growth further. We still haven't seen any labor force response to improve job opportunities. We've seen a lot of discouraged workers as the job opportunities have been scarce, but now that they're becoming more widely available, we can expect some return of some encouraged workers to come back into the labor force now that they feel that they have a better chance of finding work. And finally, you know, the balance sheets of households and businesses are still in great shape. Businesses are very profitable and sitting on a lot of cash, and so this creates, you know, a sound backdrop and suggests that there may be some room for future growth going forward. So much of our discussion today is going to be about a little bit of these upside risks and the potential that we will outperform the forecast going forward. So to begin, we'll talk about where we are today, and I'm going to hand it over to Josh, who is our human database, to talk about some of the current indicators about the performance of the Oregon economy.
Thanks, Mark. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Josh Lanner, Office of Economic Analysis. And what you see in front of you are just four standard economic indicators for the state of Oregon. They're called coincident indicators, so they neither lead the business cycle nor lag the business cycle. And they're almost all... They all are moving in the right direction with a little bit of pickup in terms of growth and employment, like Mark talked about, and he will speak to that here shortly. I want to focus on the upper right-hand graph is the hours worked in manufacturing. Our production facilities, our production workers, you know, all the manufacturers across the state are doing much better today than they have in the last couple of years. They're all the way back to the point where they're, you know, the average worker is more than 40 hours per week. Moving forward, with the expansion continuing, we're expecting some manufacturing employment to pick up, right? You work your existing employees as hard as you can before you take the risk and bring on another worker. And right now, they're working full shifts, most of the manufacturing across the state. So it's pretty broad-based. The wages and salaries growth, it's a little slow, you know, 4 or 5% a year in terms of wages and salaries and personal income in Oregon. It's a little slower than we're used to in the past couple of expansions, but you can see over time has been pretty consistent and steady. The unemployment rate is down to 7.7% based on the last monthly statistics that came out just the other day. It is mostly good news. We're adding some jobs. You know, more people are finding work. It is unfortunately not at all. It's not a purely a good story because we are getting a lower participation rate in terms of the labor force, and we are seeing more discouraged workers that are dropping out completely. So it's not a purely a good story, unfortunately. But the job growth in the upper left-hand corner has picked up. You can kind of see the slope of that line has accelerated a little bit since the beginning of 2013, which is good news. And Mark's going to talk about that here in the next slide.
Yeah, we were banking on this acceleration for some time, a couple of years in our outlook. And as we got closer to the 13-15 biennium, we were sweating more and more, hoping that it would occur. But luckily enough, here we are. You see the blue line here is employment changes for all counties in Oregon. As you see, it's accelerated significantly in 2013. And again, that's caused a lot by becoming more broad-based, that we're seeing this expansion and job gains spread to a lot of the more of the rural areas of the state. Usual suspect here would be housing-related activity, construction jobs, and more broadly, housing-related jobs in mortgage brokers and real estate agents and home supply stores and whatnot. We're seeing quite a bit of output and employment in those sectors, and that shows in terms of the great performance or recent growth in some of the epicenter of the housing downturn, namely Central Oregon, Southern Oregon. Some of these places are among those that are coming back the strongest. But it's not just those places. It's really getting more and more broad-based. Although still slow, we're seeing acceleration in some of our weakest areas, South Coast, South Central, and Southeast Oregon in particular. Here we're starting to see improvement there as well, just not as hardy as we've seen in the South and Central Oregon. The only place here that is not really showing, the only region that's really not showing improvement over the last few months, two regions, the North Coast and Northeast Oregon. The North Coast has been doing relatively well throughout the recession. So, too, has Northeast Oregon. And the story in Northeast Oregon has a lot to do with the industrial structure there. A lot of the big drivers in Northeast Oregon in recent years have not been connected tightly to the nationwide business cycle. In particular, the price of wheat hasn't been correlated with our growth rate overall in the economy, and nor has the federal spending on the Umatilla Weapons Depot, which has gone away recently. And so these things have caused the Northeast Oregon to have a different business cycle pattern than the rest of the state. But nevertheless, across the board, we're starting to see, or for the most part, we're starting to see improvement in all regions of the state. And once again, the biggest improvements have been in these places that were the hardest hit by the housing downturn. Here we see Oregon. So employment losses compared with those in Bend and Medford. So at the worst of the recession, Oregon lost 10% of its jobs, while Bend lost twice as many at the worst. But now in recent months, we see a lot of improvement. And the right-hand graph shows you the two main factors why Bend is improving and Medford as well. And that is the blue line would be housing output. We see the housing employment is up double digits in Bend, double-digit growth rates. And we also look at government employment, where the bleeding has stopped. Now, the government numbers, these are growth rates. In terms of raw numbers, they're more dramatic. But in essence, our rural areas are all highly dependent on both of these industries, both housing-related and public sector industries, which have been particularly hard hit during this cycle. Going forward now, we're finally starting to see some of those weights come off, and as a result, we're seeing faster growth across the state. Now, one way we're trying to look at things, where it's very difficult to look at some of the timely economic indicators and data because they're very subject to revision and sometimes can give a misleading story. So we like to supplement those with more idiosyncratic or anecdotal evidence. And one indicator we've been playing with lately is this comes out of the Employment Department's work on around the state. They have workforce analysts in every region of the state that look for news. Economic news, if there's an opening of a business or a night shift is shut down or a business hires 10 more people, they do a monthly report that lists these. And so what we've tried to do is put this put numbers to this report. Now, there are a lot of caveats here. These numbers were never intended. The Employment Department will tell you they're never intended to be put in a time series like I've done here. They've changed over time, the number of analysts they've had, the direction those analysts have been given in terms of what stories to report and what not to. These things change over time, so it's not necessarily consistent, but nevertheless, it's a way of, I find it to be useful, maybe not looking across time as much, but to look at the current level of chatter out there. What are businesses saying? What sort of news is hitting? So this first graph shows just bad news. How many either job cuts or layoffs or closings are announced? Now, the way we put this data together, we don't indicate size. So whether it's good or bad, we just label each one of these announcements with either a good or a bad label on it. So if you, so for example, you close the headquarters of Willamette Industries, that announcement gets no more weight than if a town opens a Jamba Juice and hires three more people. So these two things are, one would be a good thing, a Jamba Juice being opened, and another would be a bad thing, Willamette Industries being bought out. Each is equally weighted in this. So it's really just a overall idea of the chatter. So first, when we look at the bad news, we see here, on average, around the states, we're only seeing five examples of bad stories in them right now, which is about as low as we get. It's about where we were at the middle of the last recovery in the housing boom, as a matter of fact. We were only seeing 5 to 10 a month in terms of bad stories. So far, no real smoke in terms of major layoff announcements or whatnot, which tend to precede any sharp downturn in the state. Balancing the good news with the bad news, it also tells a similar story here. We see this is where we just take all the good news stories and we put them on top, and in the denominator we throw in all the bad news. And it's not a perfect indicator, as you see, but it tends to be related and lead employment growth by 6 months or so. It does tend to have a little bit of a leading indicator feel for employment growth, and as you see now, aside from a spike in 2011, we're about as high as we have been in terms of the share of good news to bad news since the recession began. So in terms of this chatter and this anecdotal evidence, to date, there's nothing that would suggest that our expansion is going to get derailed anytime soon. That said, at the U.S. level, we've seen kind of less optimism. not kind of, clearly less optimism in terms of the consensus of U.S. forecasters have been telling, have been downgrading the upside risk to the outlook for some time. And Josh is going to get into some detail on that.
And so what you see here is this is a survey from the Wall Street Journal of Economic Forecasters, 50-some-odd forecasters such as ourselves, but across the country, a lot of private sector folks. And the green bars show the upside versus downside share of risk to the outlook. If you're above 50, that means most people think that there is more upside risk than downside risk to the economy. And you can see there early in 2013, the green bars were above the 50 mark, so that most people think, you know, we're going to grow faster than slower was the more likely outcome. You can see, unfortunately, that's been all erased in recent months. A lot of those good news indicators, if you read the comment sections on some of these surveys, they're all housing related, right? We know the housing industry is coming back. Mark showed you the graph of what's going on in Bend with the housing related employment. GDP growth was a little bit stronger in residential construction activities, and everyone's feeling, you know, housing will provide a really big boost to the economy. It's becoming a driver moving forward. Everything was getting a little bit more optimistic. The probability of recession dropped down to the, you know, low teens, mid teens, somewhere in, I think the last point is about 13-15% probability of recession. So pretty low. Unfortunately, that has all gone away in recent months. A lot of that has to do with the dysfunction in Washington, D.C. People are scared about what federal policy will do, either for good or for bad. And so you can see there just the green bars have evaporated. More people are pessimistic. They downgraded their GDP forecast for 2013. On the right, you can see the red line. A lot of that has to do with just tracking. We've had another year of lackluster growth as a nation overall, even if we have seen improvement here in Oregon. With that being said, the blue bar, the blue line you see on the right-hand graph, everyone's expecting 2014 to be better, right? Everyone's expecting the economy to pick up, the growth rate to improve. And so the next slide talks about what are some of the sources of optimism, you know, where we think this growth is going to improve. Here in Oregon, we've seen it primarily in our hardest hit housing areas in addition to some of our more rural areas. The Portland metropolitan area, obviously the largest population base and economy in the state, has been pretty steady for 3 years now at a decent rate of growth. We're seeing a pickup in the smaller metropolitan areas and the more rural areas. What this first graph shows you is that across the country, the metropolitan areas, the metropolitan counties, are growing at the same rate they did during the housing boom. I think that sort of, you know, surprises some people when you think about it in that regard. And it should be pointed out that the housing boom was not a particularly high hurdle to cross. As a country as a whole, you know, we're only adding a couple percentage points of job growth. That's pretty lackluster. But what the steady rate of growth, that you see across the country masks is the regional divergence. And the second graph shows you where these jobs are actually coming from. You can see the Northeast today is doing just about as well as the Northeast did during the housing boom. The Midwest is doing twice as well as they did during that time. And the Midwest, you know, is hard hit with the manufacturing and the auto industry in recent decades. And so they're now rebounding a little bit and adding significant jobs above the pace they saw during the mid-2000s. And what you see here is the South and the West are lagging behind relative to what they were doing a decade ago. And a lot of that has to do with housing and population growth. Those are two things that Oregon in particular has thrived on in recent decades. You know, our influx of domestic migrants is slower than it has been in recent years. And then our housing sector is now coming back because all those domestic migrants need somewhere to live. And that turns into a lot of those good middle-wage jobs, those middle-income jobs, in addition to stronger economic activity. And so just as we saw the housing market turn around and Bend and Medford, and so we've seen a pickup in growth here in the state of Oregon overall. Is this pattern replicable across the country? Can we see the same sort of geographic nature of the recovery that we see here in Oregon boost overall U.S. growth? And I think the answer to some was a little bit yes. Here you can see the 50 hardest hit housing metropolitan countries or counties in the country. They're growing faster than everywhere else at the moment, right? They fell further. You can see the red line was substantially worse during the recession, but they're bouncing back stronger. These are predominantly in the western states. 33 out of these 50 metropolitan areas are in the west. Another 13 of them are in Florida alone, which is dragging down the south job gains. If you look at the south outside of Florida, the gains are basically just as strong as we saw a decade ago. So moving forward, we think as the recovery advances and the housing sector continues to help be a driver in that recovery, we can get a little bit broader based gains across the geography of the country, and that should help boost the overall growth rate. And then, another issue is what types of jobs are being created today and what type of workers are finding those jobs. And unfortunately, again, it's not always purely a good story. The graph on the left shows, our educational attainment in the state has been picking up. It's been improving. We have a lot of young individuals in college right now that are advancing their education and hopefully will become productive workers moving forward in the economy. But here you can see the share of new hires that have at least some college education. That's picked up in some of these industries that you don't tend to think of as requiring a college degree to work in. And so that has negative impact on the jobs ladder, if you will, along the wage spectrum and along the educational attainment spectrum, that if you have a college degree and you can't find a good job that requires a college degree, you get shifted down the ladder and you're maybe taking a part-time retail clerk position, or maybe you're working at a hospitality industry at the local hotel or motel in the area. And so then what that does is push other individuals further down the ladder. Those people that would typically work in those occupations, those industries that maybe don't have a college degree, they then have to find work in another industry or no work at all. And so this has some big long-term consequences for the labor market, but hopefully overall, as we get stronger growth, more broad-based growth, particularly in some of the middle-wage jobs that we talked about last time we were in front of you, that we'll start to see this pick up and broader gains across the spectrum of workers in Oregon. And then lastly, part-time workers in Oregon has started to come back down as a share of the overall workforce. The spike you see there during the recession was due to a poor economy. People's hours were cut due to the low levels of sales for businesses, and so the businesses had to cut back the hours work for their employees. And so you see a skyrocketing in the share of part-time work. If the data is to believe, it's still preliminary, that downtick there at the end for the Oregon numbers in 2013, if that's to believe, that's really good news, because it's going to mean that more people are working full-time and they're not just having their hours cut. Moving forward, we are concerned, obviously, with any potential impacts of the Affordable Care Act. You've probably seen stories in the media, heard the anecdotal evidence about, the 30 hours per week threshold that's built into the law, the 50 employees per business that's built into the law in terms of the employer mandate. So it'll be something we're monitoring closely moving forward to see if we are seeing a real shift from full-time to part-time work. But so far, that doesn't seem to be happening. But again, we're still, we're over a year out from when that mandate actually goes into effect. So again, we'll be monitoring closely. Lastly, this just shows you our employment growth outlook here in Oregon. You can see for the last 2 years, a lot of these lines are indistinguishable from each other from an economic point of view, but obviously any bump or wiggle or shift in that line is hundreds of million dollars from a budget perspective, and we realize that has significant consequences in terms of the actions you guys take, but in terms of the outlook, our office has been pretty stable in recent years, partially because it's due to tracking and partially because we have a stable outlook in terms of what the job growth forecast is.
And so that translates into the bottom line, a pretty stable revenue outlook for the general fund. Here's our tracking across time of our forecast for our 2013-15 resources. The red section signifies law changes made during the session. That was the special session in October that just occurred. And the general fund, that equates to $168 million of additional revenue expected. As you notice, the blue part, the baseline forecast based on our economic outlook and revenue tracking, is down slightly, $30 million. Roughly, or $31 million from the last forecast. But on net, of course, it's increased because of the tax changes, and that it should be noted that as a result, we are now getting closer to a kicker in terms of the personal income kicker. This gets us about halfway there. Typically, legislative changes don't impact legislative changes have not impacted the kicker calculation. The way the income tax kicker is set is we take a snapshot after the May odd year large session, and we fold in any legislative changes that were made to our most recent, that in this case, May forecast. We set that for the next 2 years as the bar with which we will compare revenues to determine a future kicker. Well, that fixed target now is now gets impact or is not impacted as we have February sessions and any special sessions like we had in October. So any law changes you make with revenue impacts will filter straight through to the kicker calculation. So in this case, the personal income tax kicker, which is poorly named because it's not really just personal income taxes, it's all general fund resources excluding corporate. We're roughly halfway there. In terms of a corporate taxes, if we still had a kicker in law, which we do not for this biennium, we would be calling for a small one at this point. Tracking over the past biennium has looked pretty good. Here is personal income taxes, and we've crossed the first big hurdle of the biennium. All bets are still off because we're a personal income tax state and we haven't had an April yet. We haven't had a peak filing season, so we're still working on limited information, but the first hurdle being the extension filing season, it looks like we've passed without event with some healthy revenue growth. This is important because a lot of our variability or volatility in the revenue forecast has to do with investment forms of income, capital gains and business income and the like. And these tend to be concentrated among our highest income and wealthiest households who tend to have the most complicated personal income tax returns and, as a rule, file for extensions. They'll pay up front in April, but then reconcile in October. So since we got such large payments this year in April, and we're a little concerned that there would be some buyback in the fall, but as it turns out, fall was healthy as well. In fact, it showed that this pulling forward of investment income appears to have been even stronger than we thought 3 months ago. In terms of corporate taxes, the story isn't so sanguine. In fact, we're really seeing no growth whatsoever, and in November in particular has been very weak. So we're crossing our fingers. December is the big month for this quarter. To see if it will reflect what we have here. Part of the picture you see here has to do with timing. In terms of the way the Department of Revenue has processed returns this year, they are taking extra time on the big refunds and suspending them and giving them one more once-over. What this has done, as you see here in terms of our growth rates, is early in the payment series, we're seeing relatively large, strong growth. At the beginning of the year, it was 50% year-over-year gains in these collections. And then when these refunds are released, we give that back. As you saw here, June and July, we were giving back a third of our collections over those periods. The same thing happened as we get later into the year here with this September quarterly payment. The September quarterly payment was big and healthy and gave us a reason for optimism, but in the subsequent months it has gone away and brought us back down to close to our flat outlook that we've been calling for. The other bad piece of news has been state taxes. Bad news is probably not the right way to say it. When people die, it's not good news. But in terms of a revenue event, estate taxes are responsible for a third of this $30 million downgrade we have for the current biennium, which is quite a bit off of the base here. And as you see, the most recent quarter, we haven't seen anything this low in 8 or 9 years in terms of these estate taxes. And so this is something we're monitoring very closely. We had a very big 2012, which led us to believe that maybe estate taxes weren't as bad off as we thought in the past. After the housing crash, we thought that estate taxes would be depressed because housing values were depressed, and a lot of folks with over $1 million worth of taxable estates have big houses and a lot of land. So we thought, well, maybe this will be depressed for quite a while, but last year it sure wasn't. And so we made a more optimistic outlook just in time for the bottom to drop off. And so this is something we're going to watch. The CPAs that we talk to are concerned as well that there's some long-term erosion in estate taxes insofar as folks are managing their estates better, preempting the estate tax. They're managing it better while they're alive and lowering their tax burden when it occurs. But as well as corporate income taxes would be where we are worried about downgrades in the near term. The nature of the current forecast, as I hinted at when we were talking about the personal income taxes, we're really kind of having a weak tax year 2013. And it doesn't have to do with the labor market. As I've just suggested before, these withholdings out of the paychecks are growing faster than they have been before. But we're expecting a little bit of an issue in terms of the non-wage income, the investment type income. Even though we're still at these record stock market prices, and we've seen increases in our housing prices as well and home equity, we still feel that it's going to be a middling or flat year in terms of our April returns. And why is that? Well, it's because last year was so big. Last year in 2012, in advance of federal tax increases, we saw our high income taxpayers pull a lot of this investment type income and realize it for tax purposes into 2012. What that means is there's fewer taxable gains to be realized going forward. In particular, this year in 2013, we expect somewhat of a hangover. Here is, we have almost all of the extended filers in for 2012, so these are almost a finalized number in terms of matching the income of Oregonian filers from 2011 to 2012. And as you see here, for our wealthiest or highest income filers, those affected by the Measure 66, the income growth among these non-wage forms of income, capital gains and dividends, was really dramatic. 70% growth in capital gains year over year, 45% growth in dividends. Obviously, this isn't sustainable. But that said, this would create a potential for upside risk because the asset prices are just doing so well this year. It's very hard for us to call for a flat April going forward. So there is the potential that we are being too pessimistic as we head into it. And really, this is where it would hit. This is a picture of our capital gains. Is the black line, billions are on the left. And compared with Wilshire 5000 stock price index, and as you see here, that huge gain in 2012 has brought us back up about halfway back from the peak of during the housing boom in terms of our realizations of capital gain. Now, despite continued expectations of asset price growth, which is a dicey forecast on its own, we have really no growth in capital gains expected during tax year 2013. And again, as you see here, it's just a timing issue. 2014 and 15, we expect it to pick back up in keeping with the underlying asset prices if those hold up. But this is obviously the most uncertain part of our outlook. That said, for 2013-15, if we can make it through December 31st of this year without a stock market crash, we should be okay for the current biennium. Obviously, we get through the calendar year 2013 should save us in terms of the 2013 taxes, but any crash that would happen in 2014, probably the worst of it wouldn't be felt until the 15-17 biennium. When the equity market corrects, we have a lot of folks selling off. And when they sell this off, if they have some gains, they'll realize those for tax purposes as they're dumping their stock portfolios. So this will artificially or temporarily keep our taxable capital gains high for a year or so until then in the subsequent biennium, the bottom would drop out. So looking at the specific forecast summary and the details of our changes here for the current biennium, we are looking at an increase in net available resources of $136 million. Sounds good. Of course, that's in comparison with tax law changes in the special session of the magnitude of $168 million. So we do see a downgrade in the forecast, as you see here, coming from two places. We have decreased the beginning balance by $11 million in keeping with some accounting issues. And then we've changed the forecast based on our new outlook for state court fees and for inheritance taxes has dropped by $20 million. So these are the fundamental changes that we're bringing today, is that $31 million decline in resources, which is really what is new today. The special session impacts reflect what the legislature was told by the Legislative Revenue Office as those bills were being drafted. So at this time, all the legislative impacts are matching those. Some of them are quite uncertain, however, and so going forward, as we start to get hard data on these, which will be some time, quite a while in some cases, when we start to get hard data on what these tax law changes are doing, at that point, we'll revisit these assumptions. But right now, this reflects the revenue impact statement, the most recent revenue impact statement. So on that, really, what we're seeing here is increases in the personal and corporate taxes, again, due to the legislation, leads us to see around $130 million, again, this biennium, and then more in the out years. In the out years, in addition to the legislative changes, we also have a bit more personal income tax growth expected. This flows from a slightly stronger outlook for job gains and wage gains. Over the long-term horizon, we expect revenue growth to slow and not match its historic rates. Historically, when we have an expansion over a biennium, Oregon has seen general fund revenues increase by 15-16% per biennium. In the out years here, we have it down in the neighborhood of 10%. The reason for that over the long run is really largely a story about demographics. As the peak, the number of folks in our peak working age cohort shrinks, the effectiveness of most state tax instruments, in particular our personal income taxes, but sales taxes as well, erode. And that has a lot to do with both the spending habits and the income of older individuals. Here, our demographer has culled the census data to split out different income of our residents to kind of try to pound this point home that our tax instruments are going to become less effective going forward. Here are folks below the poverty level income. So on average in Oregon, they're getting $6,000 a year in income, something along those lines, per person that's below the poverty level. But this is to basically show what sort of a low income pattern would be like. And as you see here, as folks in Oregon age, their wage income gets replaced by this big green section, which is Social Security income. Obviously, the impact there on us is the fact that, well, Social Security income is not subject to Oregon income tax. So for low-income individuals, there's very little in terms of taxable income expected as they age. The story's a little bit better for if you look at all folks put together in terms of taxable income. Here we see folks in their 60s and 70s do have some significant retirement income, pensions and the like, as well as some of this non-wage stuff, interest, dividend, and rent and the like, investment forms of income. But even here, you see those are going to add on average to $15,000 or $20,000 of taxable income per person in comparison to twice that in their peak earning years. And so as our baby boom population cohort moves into these income categories, not only are we going to see less economic growth out there, but our tax interest instruments are going to be able to extract less of that for state and public services. So with that, that's the end of our prepared remarks, but we'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you. I want to welcome Chair Barnhart and Vice Chairs Bailey and Berger to our committee here and invite them to join in the questioning. So do we have questions? We surely have questions.
Well, may I?
Chair Barnhart.
Madam Chair, thank you. I simply want to thank you and the committee, the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee, for inviting the House Revenue Committee to sit in this morning. I think a number of the members are interested and have questions to ask. I would like to note, and I may have a question or two later, but I would like to note that while we would certainly appreciate a higher growth rate if we could get it, because it would be good for the economy, good for jobs, the state economist is to be complimented that so far, at least, he seems to have done a pretty good job of predicting where we actually come out. And that is, based on our experience, a pretty unusual event. The one thing we know for certain almost all the time is that the state economist is going to be wrong. In this case, he seems to be right, and that's unusual.
I'm sure your days are limited.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator. I don't think we'll be spiking the ball anytime soon.
Other questions? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your report. It's always extremely interesting. I actually had two questions that they're, I hope, not related. The first has to do with the ongoing attempts by the Federal Reserve to keep the economy liquid to avoid deflation. And the tapering that we're now hearing about is anticipated to have some sort of an effect. And I'd like your thoughts on that. The other question is the ACA and the impact of the income shift, or the income shift, if you will, from those who make money to those who don't. If you view that as being in kind of an inside the economy issue that's not going to have outward dampening impacts on expenditures, those two questions.
All right, so first on the tapering in terms of Federal Reserve policy, one concern that we've been discussing a lot with the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors is the potential that this tapering will happen sooner or more drastically than financial markets are expecting right now. The Federal Reserve has been very clear in its guidance and in its expected policy path, saying that they're going to keep at least rates, if not the quantitative side, but at least rates fully accommodative until 2015 at some point, when it will start to raise rates. Well, when you look at the decision models that monetary policymakers have used in the past, they would likely be tightening policy before that point. And so the concern would be that, as we've seen these markets really react to any increase in interest rates in recent time, or any news that the tapering was going to take place, should this happen, if monetary policymakers have an incentive to act sooner, should it happen sooner, that certainly could change expectations. And expectations are really fragile right now. It seems somewhat perverse to me that if we get a bad U.S. jobs report, suddenly the stock market shoots up, because now investors say, well, now it's less likely that the Federal Reserve is going to start doing any tapering or tightening, so that's good news. And it's, for me, it seems that's hard to take, thinking that investors should be forward-looking and probably will have priced in a lot of this tapering. But just how sensitive those asset prices have been to any sort of news out of the Fed is obviously scary, given how much we depend on the capital gains and this sort of non-wage income. Moving on to the Affordable Care Act, there are certainly redistributional impacts of the law for us in terms of the overall economic punch the impact on the forecast. A lot of it has to do not so much with the redistribution, but overall, to what extent are we increasing spending in rural areas, and to what extent are we able to bend the cost curve. and create more value for the economy as a whole. That's, you know, that's what we tend to focus on rather than the redistributional impacts, which are significant.
Representative Conger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mark or Josh, this is an opinion question, I guess, but do you have an explanation for why Oregon has, it looked like 7 or 8% more part-time jobs, as a whole or as a share of the total workforce than the rest of the country on average?
Do you want to? Yeah, sure. Well, thank you, Representative Conger. That has been the case historically. I personally do not have a good explanation for why we do have more part-time work than the average state. One of the things we do know is that we work less hours overall, and that's across pretty much all industries, not just in our leisure and hospitality industries, which do tend to be more part-time than others in our retail sales. Even our manufacturing hours worked. If you remember the very first graph, you know, we're above 40 right now, maybe 41 hours a week work for our manufacturing workers. Well, the U.S. is more like 42 hours, right? So even something where we do really good job at, that we have a comparative advantage relative to other states, Oregon workers do tend to work a little bit less hours just across the board. There's only a couple industries where we do, and so obviously right there the translation of we work less hours, therefore you have more part-time work. That's a direct linkage right there. And so then the question becomes, is that a good thing, a bad thing, is it a neutral thing? And obviously if people want full-time work and they can only find part-time, that's a bad thing. But if people are actively choosing to work a few less hours to increase their leisure time with their family or vacation or what have you, then it's less of a concern. But beyond that, I don't have any additional information personally.
Representative Conger, I think a lot of it has to do, you'll see, in terms of the nature of Oregon's labor force, it's different than the typical state. Another thing that shows up is more part-time workers, and also as a baseline, in good times and bad, we have somewhat higher unemployment rates. And we have a very young, flexible labor market compared to a lot of places. So part of this is reflected. Part of it has to do with the industry mix. We have more retail jobs than the average state. And we also have more agriculture jobs and seasonal jobs than the typical state in agriculture and other resource industries. So in the past, we see a lot of these measures of workforce friction, part-time work or unemployment rates, always tend to be a little bit higher here than in some of the more stable states, I might say. In particular, compared with a lot of the country areas that are highly unionized or the Midwest manufacturing hubs, those are the places where you would see less part-time work than average, whereas economies like our Western ones, the opposite is true.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the last several estimates that you gave, I think you gave fairly specific comments about the upside and the downside risks and what you saw as the percentage on those two things, and also the odds of a kicker occurring. That's the first question. Second question is, have you considered, and I'm sure you have, population changes, and what do we anticipate now in terms of population? What have we just had, and what do we anticipate population changes in the state of Oregon?
All right. Yes. Okay. So, in terms of the upsides and downside risk to the outlook, we presented the Wall Street Journal survey, which showed a little upside. The recession risk here now is down to 15% roughly on average. Now, the vendor we use, that would be the red line in the left-hand side graph, shows the probability that we'll enter into a recession over the next year. Our vendor, Global Insight, has the risks balanced, 20% on the upside, 20% on the downside. The downside risks are still the same old that we've been communicating. Problems in terms of the European Union, potential for other trading partners, China weakening, and the dysfunction in Washington, D.C. being the largest ones that are stated on the downside. But I worry, and this is another thing we discussed with the advisors, what are we not looking for? Because that's probably what's going to knock us off our recovery. So there are probably more broad risks. We're trying to get people to articulate these and having a difficult time. Now, on the upside, I think there is quite a bit. Like I said, we have more room in housing. We have more rural areas that haven't come back yet. We have labor force hasn't shown any kind of response to the improved job opportunities yet, and we still have strong balance sheets with profitable and cash-heavy companies. So there's quite a bit of potential risk on the upside. And particularly since we're saying, okay, we've topped out now in our baseline outlook, this is about as fast as we're going to get, well, that doesn't look like the historical Oregon recovery. The historical Oregon recovery has been more of a boom-bust phenomenon where we get a year or two of real strong growth and then a fall-off. Our outlook looks much smoother than that, largely because the problem with timing when that fall off would occur would make the revenue errors larger if we tried to put in some kind of cycle. But that said, when we look at our outlook, it doesn't really pass the eyeball test. It would suggest that we would have stronger growth in the near term if it follows historical just eyeball patterns, which, as we see here, we're getting very close to the kicker. And so there is a somewhat high probability of a kicker, less than 50%. It's not in our baseline outlook, but there is a possibility of one this biennium.
And population?
And population growth, yes. We've seen a little pickup, just under 1% a year in the most recent outlook. Still not our traditional advantage. When we have this kind of job opportunity advantage, particularly vis-a-vis California, we're used to seeing more domestic migrants, folks from within other states coming to Oregon. We're still netting people. We're netting them from almost everywhere, maybe one or two metro areas excluded, Austin, Texas, and a couple others. But we're basically still a magnet. But the size of those flows have not come back since the housing downturn, and a lot of that may have to do with folks trapped in bad loans or bad housing markets.
Could I follow up just very briefly? What demographic are we talking about? Are we talking about mostly young people moving around, or talking about retirees, or what is it?
Yeah, Representative Barnhart, the vast majority of domestic migrants do so for work. They're young folks in their 20s and 30s relocating for work. And these are incredibly powerful for regional economic development. These folks in their root-setting years, they come in, they buy their homes, they buy their durable goods, their sofas and their stereos, and or I guess nobody buys stereos anymore, but whatever it may be, and basically set up their lives. So this is incredibly powerful, and it's what our metropolitan areas have excelled at in past.
And if I could, Madam Chair, I'd simply note that I think is an addition to the answer that was given to Representative Conger's question about part-time work.
Mm-hmm. Representative Biggar-Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for this presentation. It's always very informative. So both of you had mentioned at one time about cash-heavy corporations. Are we seeing a corresponding increase in wages both at the national level and the Oregon level? Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, Representative Biggar-Peterson, we have not seen a lot of the profitability translate into wages. We are seeing a little bit of acceleration in wage growth, and it's getting that's encouraging, but not yet. And the conventional wisdom there would be we still have a loose labor market. We still have a lot of unemployment out there. And until that slack is taken up, it's hard to maintain a lot of wage gains. There's always someone else who's willing to take the lower wage, and therefore businesses happily pay it.
Can I have a follow-up, please?
Thank you. And so the fact that we're not seeing this, do you think that has any impact on the type of recovery that we're seeing in Oregon that's different than what we've seen in the past?
Yeah, absolutely, Representative. That and the fact that households need to save more is resulting in a different pattern than we've seen in the past in terms of less consumer-oriented growth. That has dictated across the country ever since World War II, really consumers have led growth. In every decade, we've seen consumer spending grow faster than overall economic output, you know, with exports, investment, the like. And that we're expecting is changing now. This current decade is the first time since World War II where that will be flipped, that growth is going to be led, albeit slower growth, but it's going to be led by firm investment demand, export, and the like. While we're still going to see some consumer growth, that's going to be slower. And part of that has to do with the wage story. Part of it is a saving story.
Thank you.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious just if you could spell it out for me clearly. If the kicker does kick, what are we looking at in terms of the size of the kicker relative to the magnitude of the revenue that we raised during the special session?
Ah, Representative Bailey, yes. We can say the kicker is roughly $300 million is the threshold in a regular biennium, so $168 million of general fund that was raised. Oh, I guess we have to, I'm sorry, we net out the corporate there. So it's if we net out the 74 corporate, we're looking at, what, 90-something in terms of the personal income tax revenue that's applicable to the kicker. So 90-something would be a third of the way to the 300 threshold. And once we get anything over that is kicked, plus the initial 300 is also given back to taxpayers. You go all the way to that first 2% is the 300. That's returned, plus anything in excess of that would be returned as a credit on their tax returns next year.
Thank you.
Or next biennium, sorry.
So your answer is basically everything we did would go back.
That's right. If we get there, now there's still a February session between now and then, which allows for management opportunities that weren't there in the past.
Okay. Other questions?
Yes.
I think that was a rhetorical comment. All right. There are no further questions. Thank you very much. It's been informative. Encouraging, if a little worrisome in some areas, especially the kicker. But thank you very much. And committee, we will be on break until 9:20. The Senate Finance and Revenue Committee will reconvene, again welcoming our Honorable Chair from House Revenue to participate in this discussion. Our next agenda item is property tax trends, early indications for the 2013-14 collections county with the County Assessors Panel. Sorry. So, Christine.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the collections picture overall looks to be improved for 2013-14 as the housing market continues to recover. It still might have some way to go, but it seems that it might be safe to say the worst of it is over. Today, we have Scott Langdon from Deschutes County, Michael Coles from Lane County, and Bob Vroman from Clackamas County to explain the situations in their respective counties and to talk about the, it seems that in some cases, real market values are recovering.
Okay, why don't you join us? Welcome.
Good morning. Are you ready?
We're ready.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Representative Senator. I'm Scott Langton. I'm the Deschutes County Assessor. As the other two were already introduced, but it's kind of interesting how we have a property tax system that's statewide, but we have very differing kind of impacts and results depending where you're at. So hopefully we can give you a good representation of that. We'd like to start it off with a informational video that Deschutes County put together this year to kind of explain some of the issues. So I'll get that started and hopefully.
Okay. If the technology cooperates here.
Let's see.
Some lights.
Deschutes County. Those of us that live here know it's a special place. And many that visit want to move here. But if you own property in Deschutes County, you also know what crazy times it's been in the last few years regarding property values, which makes for real challenges at the assessor's office. Real market value, assessed value, maximum assessed value. You say tomato, we say tomato, but it comes out confusing all the same. I'm Scott Langton, your county assessor, and I'd like to prepare you for a crazy combination of Measure 50 and our recent real estate market value fluctuations. Please don't shoot the messenger, but some of you might be in for a bit of a surprise when you receive your property tax bill this fall. Now we've come up with a method for you to review your tax situation in a graphic way. To explain this, we've enlisted the aid of the property tax fairy to tell you a story. The story of Measure 50 and the three tax lots.
What are you looking at?
Have you
never seen a property tax fairy before? Well, get comfortable.
Is there any more volume that we can do on this, or is that all we have?
That's all we have. I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Wait for the curtain to go. We should have stopped it earlier. Sorry about that.
And pay attention, because we haven't much time.
Speaking of time, that's what this story is all about. Let's fire up the property tax time machine and go back to 1997. Then, Oregon voters passed Measure 50, which was designed to limit property taxes. Measure 50 created what's called the maximum assessed value, which was the real market value of your property in 1995, less 10%. Here's an example. In 1997, the real market value of this property was $140,000. The maximum assessed value of this house was set at $126,000. Over the next 10 years or so, the real market value of this property steadily increased, but Measure 50 ensured that the maximum assessed value only increased by 3% on this home. So the owners of this property saw only minor increases in their tax bill, while they enjoyed a major increase in the real market value of the property. Then the real estate bubble burst, and the property values began to fall. Because the maximum assessed value was so far below the real market value on this property, the maximum assessed value still increased 3% annually by law. And that's why property taxes still kept going up, despite the market value going down. That's pretty straightforward, right? This homeowner enjoyed the benefit of lower taxes, despite fluctuating property values. A lot of new construction has occurred in Deschutes County since then. When a house is first built, it receives its initial real market value, and also with that, its maximum assessed value. The assessed value is the lower of these and becomes the baseline for calculating your property taxes. Now here's where it gets a little tricky and becomes a job for the property tax fairy.
Because of the crazy real estate market we've been having the last few years and the ongoing effects of Measure 50, we may see some wildly different changes in the maximum assessed value of some Deschutes County properties, even if the properties are very similar to each other.
We've told you about Measure 50. Now let's illustrate the current situation. Here we have a typical subdivision in Bend. It was started in 2006, and a developer built several homes before the market started changing. As the housing market went down, it took several years to complete more homes in the subdivision. This home was completed and therefore assessed for tax purposes in 2006. At that time, the property's real market value was $280,000. Its maximum assessed value was about $120,000. The home right next to it was built in 2009. Its real market value was determined to be $200,000, and its maximum assessed value, $166,000. Then, in 2012, this third house was finished. Its real market value was $190,000, and its maximum assessed value was $181,000. Three homes, similar sizes, same location, but three different property tax bills. Property 1, built and assessed before the peak of the housing market, has seen a big drop in real market value. Property 2, built and assessed in 2009, has seen a little less of a drop in real market value. Property 3, built as the market bottomed out, has a completely different scenario. Three properties, similar in size, design, and location, but their tax bills will be very different. Here's where Measure 50 has worked. Property 1, whose value dropped the most, saw only the normal 3% increase in its property taxes as prescribed by Measure 50. Property 2, whose value also dropped pretty significantly, now has a real market value less than their maximum assessed value. Remember, Measure 50 says the assessed value will be the lower of the real market value and the maximum assessed value. Because of that, its assessed value became the same value as the real market value, and Property 2 actually saw a 9% decrease in its property taxes last year. Again, with Property 3, this is its first year of valuation, so there's nothing to compare it to yet.
But here's the kicker. The real estate market appears to be rebounding. And as real market values rise, the assessed value will continue to be the lower of the real market value or the maximum assessed value.
However, if the market increases by more than 3% in 1 year, and the assessed value and real market value are the same, the assessed value can increase by any percentage until it reaches the maximum assessed value. Back to our three properties again. And you can see Property 1 is the most stable and will see the anticipated 3% increase. Property 3, in its second year, will also see a 3% increase. But Property 2 is going to be surprised to see a tax increase of 14%. That's because its assessed value was pegged to its real market value. And with an increase in value of 20%, it may come as a shock, but it's because of Measure 50, the law Oregon voters passed in 1997.
Oh dear, this can still be kind of confusing, can it? Which scenario is your property going to be in? Up? Down? Sideways? Well, here's where you can find out for sure.
Go to the Deschutes County Assessor's website. It's deschutes.org/graphit. There you can look up your own property and use the website to view your own cool graph. You'll see your real market value, your maximum assessed value, and the site will tell you other useful information about your property. Some will pay more, some could pay less. We just don't want you to be surprised. If you own property in Deschutes County, you gotta graph it. It's simple, and it's a valuable tool. If you don't have access to the internet, come on down. To the county offices, of course, and one of our friendly people will help you graph it right there. Of course, they're not as helpful as the property tax fairy, but what are you gonna do? Can't be everywhere, right? If you remember nothing else, remember this. Deschutes.org/graphit. Go there and graph it.
Thanks for your time, but I've got to run now. Can't miss that monthly Fairies International meeting. I hear the new Tooth Fairy's pretty hot.
So
very creative. You did that.
I had a lot of help on that. But we were trying to figure out a way that we could get information out to the general public in a way that they could follow kind of our bizarre and complex property tax system, because it does vary so drastically by property by property.
Let me ask you a detailed question on that. On that property where they saw could see a 14% increase, I thought that when the assessed value fell below the market value, that it got reset at the market value, and then it could no longer go more than 3%. We talked about it last session, trying to change that. This is maybe I'm just misunderstanding, but how does that work?
Yeah, no, Madam Chair, I think that's a common misunderstanding, and it is statutory. There was some discussion. I don't believe there was any legislation introduced that would have maybe put a circuit breaker or a limiting factor on the case when the market value was lower and it came back. But I think it's ORS 308-146, right in that thereabouts, spells out that the maximum assessed value in a year is the prior year's assessed value times 103%, or the prior year's maximum assessed, whichever is greater. So the way that, in essence, works is it flatlines that maximum assessed value for those years market value is below, and then it's a matter of how far below the market fell and how quickly the market comes back that you have that impact. So like in the case of the city limits of Redmond, we had over 5,000 accounts, which is quite a large percentage of those properties, that went up by more than 20% this year, because 83% of the properties in the city of Redmond had a market value lower. I do think you have some potential latitude legislatively if you wanted to put some circuit breakers in, but they're not in there now.
No, we weren't talking about circuit breakers. We were talking about resetting the Christine, what were you talking about?
The maximum assessed value, instead of flatlining it, the concept was to continue to grow it.
To continue to grow it.
By 3%.
Which would be the opposite impact. So then they'd even have more of it come back up.
Right.
So.
Okay. All right.
So, yeah, and that's the reason we put this together, and hopefully that put it in kind of a clear way, and then we do have the tool, at least in Deschutes County, where we wanted to have a graph for each individual property.
Oh, that's excellent. So. I think all counties should do that. Was that very big effort to get that in place?
Yeah, yes and no. I've got a lot of really good people working there. So they put that together, and then our IT department was able to put the tools together so we could do that. And I think it's been fairly well received. I've done a number of town halls, and I think it's helped explain those. Now, the gentleman in Redmond that bought in his house, a retirement home in, I think, 2011, and based his purchase on the property taxes at that time and didn't realize that there was that potential of the maximum assessed value being so much higher. When his taxes went up, it was about 28% this year. He wasn't happy. So.
Okay, thank you.
So, and actually, like I say, that it varies very much where you're at in the state on the different ramifications. This scenario is true any place you go in the state, just probably to a greater extent in Central Oregon because we had such a boom, then a bust, and now the light switch came back on, so we're seeing these properties come back up. So this is going to, some properties are now back above, and they'll be back into the 3%. Others, it will take several years of pretty good appreciation before that occurs. So, but I think I'll turn it over to get a little information on what's happening in the metropolitan area, and then maybe questions or whatever.
Great, thank you.
Welcome. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, and Representative Barnhart. My name is Bob Vroman. I'm the Clackamas County Assessor and Tax Collector, and the information that I provided to you is a representation, of course, of what happened in our county. but it is probably relatively consistent with what you would have found in the Tri-County area. And I think Scott very appropriately pointed out that, you know, real estate is location, 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 so you find varying degrees of impact depending upon where properties are located, not only around the state, but even within within counties. Because in Clackamas County, we often have a challenging story to tell because we have a very varied county. Generally, the tables that I've provided, and I understand there's a lot of numbers there, and I'll talk just briefly about those tables, but really it's a reflection of what we saw happening with Oregon's economy, which was beginning to rebound, and a real estate market that was starting to improve. And I think to put things in context, because of the presentation you had earlier, which, you know, generally is a forecast, we're talking about what's actually happened and is somewhat historical. And what I think that people don't understand sometimes is that our assessment date, because it's January 1 of each year, so January 1 of 13, we're really providing you information today on what happened in the 2012 year. So when we talk about a market that's improved, we're not really talking about yet what's happened in 2013. We're talking about what occurred in 2012. And from the very first table that I provided, I think probably the more remarkable statistic is that in 2013, for real market value of all property in Clackamas County, we showed our first year-over-year increase since 2008. Our real market value of all property increased about 4.3%. Now, that's a reflection of what's happening in the market with existing properties as well as new construction that would have taken place, and in the event that we had businesses that were moving into the county, that would also contribute to a growth in real market value. You can see on the right-hand side of that table, the taxable Measure 50 assessed value has continued to grow throughout these years, and that's just a function of Oregon's property tax system and Measure 50, which in some way Scott described. Assessed value grows really two ways. It grows as a result of that statutory 3% increase that you would typically expect under Oregon's system, plus new construction and new property that may come into the county as a result of what's happening in the market. And so you'll see that for 2013, our assessed value grew almost 3.9%, which is more typical of what it was in the years preceding our downturn in the markets. We're not back to where we were prior. Not even close. And you can see, again, when you look at real market value for Clackamas County, in 2008, our real market values were right around $60 billion in total, and we've only come back to about $45.9 billion in value. But it's generally an optimistic trend in what's happening in the market. And as far as the property tax system as a funding mechanism, what usually comes in the form of questions after talking about what's happening with value, it's that subject of compression. And compression, as this committee, I think, well knows, is represents those dollars that you don't collect as a result of exceeding our first constitutional limitations. Real market value limits of $5 on the education category and $10 per thousand of real market value in the general government category. And what you'll see in Clackamas County is that even though we had an improving real market value situation, we still had assessed value growing. The amount of compression still continued to increase, so we won't be collecting almost $20.1 million this year. But the growth in compression slowed significantly, and that's important. The other thing which I'll point out, but I'm not going to spend hardly any time with, is that you'll notice that if you look at the compression history in the general government category, you'll see that in 2012 we didn't collect about a $1.1 million, and in 2013 that's dropped to only $568,000. So it's been an improvement in the collections on the general government side, and yet if you look at the education loss amount, it's going from $17 million to almost $19.5 million. Part of that is a function of something that happened in Clackamas County that isn't typical of all counties, but we had an urban renewal area that was completed and is no longer in existence. The Clackamas Town Center plan area closed, and that has impacts to the property tax system and the amount of taxes that districts essentially are going to collect, because we take a small portion of the rate of those districts that contribute to urban renewal, and especially those education category districts, and when they're raising money for urban renewal agencies, we extend that in that general government category. And so it reduces the amount of rate that's subject to that $5 limit. Well, when an urban renewal agency goes away, that, in fact, happens in reverse. And so we take that rate out of general government category and put it back in education. And it can lead to some additional compression because of that lower $5 limit. So in Clackamas County, we had still a couple of things going on. We had that impact with urban renewal that contributed to, a little more to compression in the education category. And we still had areas where our real market values were growing, but they might not have been growing faster than that 3% growth in assessed value. So there's still some potential for compression. And you can see that on the right-hand side of that table 2, which shows the number of accounts that actually had compression loss. And I think a somewhat remarkable statistic that isn't on here is that out of the roughly 169,000 accounts we have in Clackamas County, almost 93,000 have some reduction as a result of exceeding the Measure 5's limits. Now, that situation will improve as real market values continue to grow, if they continue to grow in excess of what that 3% assessed value will ultimately grow. Tables 3 and 4 are just really for some general information, and it lists the number of accounts that we have in Clackamas County where the real market value is at or below that maximum assessed value. So those accounts, and I'll look just at 2013 real quickly and go all the way over to the right-hand side to the total number of accounts. We have 39,000 accounts where real market value is the assessed value. That's actually down from the prior year where we had 47,000 accounts. And what that tells you, again, is an indication that the real estate market is improving. So that ratio between real market value and assessed value is starting to grow, and in some cases we're seeing a reduction in the number of accounts where real market value is the assessed value. Those are the accounts that Scott was describing where you have the potential for assessed value to grow more than the typical 3% if we have a situation where real market values are growing. And then because I know that school district and education funding is a very high priority of our legislature, that last table just shows you that breakdown of the accounts where real market value was the assessed value of the school districts that we have in Clackamas County. And you can see just by glancing down the percentage change for 2013 that the picture is certainly improving for districts as far as the revenue that's being generated locally for the property tax system, from the property tax system for our school districts. And I included this information because we value the relationship we have with the legislature and the state in that funding process for local services, because still typically over 40% of the revenue raised from the property tax system still goes to fund education in this state. And we think that it's certainly a benefit to the legislature and to the state if the property tax system performs the way it's intended to perform and contributes the way it should to that funding process. And we depend on you to some extent to help us assure that there's funding for the assessment and tax function to allow us to continue to be able to participate in that partnership. And I'll let Mike tell you a little bit about what happened in his area.
Actually, if I could, real quick, I neglected to mention that I also prepared some things. It's in, I think you call it OLIS, and actually on page 2, we saw very similar trends to what Clackamas County saw in the matter of compression and the way the values have changed and the impacts there. And so there's a couple graphs there that you might refer to and get a comparison. We might have saw larger swings, but it's very similar trends where things are moving back positive. But I will note that when you look at countywide, it's very different by jurisdiction. So if you look at like the case of the city of Redmond, their assessed value because of the swings, they lost probably about 15% of their assessed value during the recession. They gained back 11% last year. Where the city of Bend was only 5%, and the city of Lapine and the city of Sisters, which are starting to show positive signs, were delayed a little bit, where they were just a little over 1%. So it's kind of on the property by property specific. It's also district by district and very varying impacts there.
So. Thank you. Thanks. Welcome.
Chair Burdick, members of the community committee, Representative Barhart, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I'm Mike Coles, Lane County Assessor. I'm trying to not be redundant with some of the information that's already been presented, so I'll be brief in my remarks. Lane County's January 1st, 2013 real market value increased to $45.6 billion from $44.8 billion the previous year. This is an overall increase of 1.8% from January 2012. Based on the sales activity in 2012, Lane County showed an overall 1.3% increase in a typical median single-family dwelling. The total taxable value of all properties in Lane County increased 2.6%, slightly under the 3% of for the maximum assessed value statutorily increase. Increased from 27.2% in 2012 to 27.9 in 2013. This change reflects a 6% increase in new construction activity. We had roughly $285 million of new construction in 2012, over $269 million the previous year. 23% of properties in Lane County now have a market value below their Measure 50 maximum assessed value, which is up slightly from 22% in 2012. The total property tax collected for all tax levies in 2013 was $440.3 million. This is approximately an 8% increase more than 2012. The amount of taxes billed charges each year are a result of new and expired levies, bond levies approved by voters, 3% statutory increase in maximum assessed value, and addition of new construction to the tax roll. In addition, it takes into account the number of exemptions granted, number of properties being taxed at the lower of the real market value versus their Measure 50 maximum assessed value. The bottom line this past year, we saw the market stabilize in Lane County. We saw a slight increase of 1 to 2% for most properties. If I may turn to the first exhibit on the second page. I have charts as far as showing from 2004 to 2013 a typical single-family dwelling. Its real market value, you can see its peak in 2007 and then its decline. You can also see the 3% increase in the maximum assessed value each year, where in 2013 it became very close, approximately 88% on average for residential properties. As previously mentioned, the accounts taxed on real market value versus their maximum assessed value vary greatly between communities in Lane County. A low of 6.4% in the River Road Park and Rec District to a high of 50.1% in the city of Cottage Grove. Lane County on whole was approximately 21-22%, and that was a little bit changed from last year, but not much. However, as we go forward in 2013-14 tax year, I suspect that with the information that we have for the real estate market, that we should see the stabilization change to an increase in real market values of approximately 5-10%, but right now that analysis has not been completed yet.
Thank you. Do you expect, if we continue on this trajectory with a maybe hopefully a less bubble-like expansion of home values and property values, that compression eventually will go away as an issue?
Not entirely, because you have certain types of properties, business, personal property, utility properties that historically have been on their market value. So if you look like at the graph that I put together on page 2, you can see back in 2006 we had for education about $500,000 loss. And then it dropped to, you know, almost $4 million in loss. It's starting to come back, but I think there'll always be certain accounts that will hit under that. And then depending on the makeup of the jurisdiction or the area, how much over that tax rate, either in the government category or the education category, those tax rates are. And that can vary very drastically. I think that Portland probably has some that the general government is considerably above, so the market value would have to get a long ways above that maximum assessed to make it go away.
Thank you. Other question?
Yeah, Chair Burdick, maybe I could add just and reinforce what Scott said in that, for instance, in Clackamas County, and I have that information in one of the tables, our business personal property, 100% of it is valued at its real market value, because basically those are depreciating assets. And the same is very true a lot of the very heavy industrial properties, which may have a lot of value, but because they are either machinery and equipment or very specialized types of construction, tend to not appreciate at all, and in fact depreciate to some extent. So we will always have the potential for some types of properties to generate that compression. But in Clackamas County, for example, the bulk of our properties are residential properties. So as real market value increases, the answer is yes. That has a positive impact on the amount of compression that we see occurring.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Okay, good. Thank you very much. It's been part of our ongoing effort to, number one, understand it, and hopefully someday do something about some of these issues.
Chair Burdick, can I get in one quick pitch? And that is, we really appreciate the opportunity to come down to Salem and appear before you. There's been a lot of discussion about how our property tax system works, and to the extent that it is accomplishing what it was intended to accomplish. And we would just like to offer that certainly we would hope that you would always be willing to engage us in a conversation about what's working well, what's not working well, how what we do is impacted based on the level of funding that we have in order to perform our function, and how that impacts the state because of your participation in funding, especially our education districts. So we would certainly offer and encourage you to contact us anytime, and we would be happy to.
Couldn't have said that better, Bob.
Yes. Thank you.
Senator Hess.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say how much I appreciate Deschutes County's treatment of trying to explain property taxes to the voters with a funny video and graphics. And I don't want to overdo this, but that is, for better or worse, the people's language these days. And to the extent that people can understand our Byzantine system of taxation, especially property taxes, then they might be able to better understand why we need to change it. And that's, I think, how you engage these voters is okay, if I see there's a problem now, it's here in this graph, and so, yes, I'll vote for this. Voters tend to vote against things they don't understand. And so I just love the fact that you did this, and I wish government could speak to people in more plain, simple language like this more often. And I can't wait for the sequel on compression to come out.
Madam Chair, Senator Haas, thank you very much, because that was our intent was exactly that. How do you get the information out there so people can understand it? Because if they might be okay with the system, they might not, but at least if they understand the system, they'll know how they want to change it. So I appreciate those comments, because that's what we tried to do, and you're not always successful, so I'm glad to hear that we might have hit the mark a little bit.
And thank you for bringing that up, because I think that's really an important point. It's very, very hard to make change or even deal with some of these complex issues if the public doesn't understand it. And so I think you've really accomplished something. I hope other counties, I hope you'll have a chance to give this at AOSC or, you know, spread it around to other counties, and maybe put some of your people on loan to help them do it. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Our next panel is...
Madam Chair, we have three elements to our next section on the special session revenue bill, which I know you all remember fondly.
We've kind of repressed it, actually.
House Bill 3601. The first thing we have for you is a research report, and it's on the overall special session. And so it does cover the five bills, but of course our focus is almost exclusively on the revenue bill, House Bill 3601, So the research report is about 95% of it's dedicated to that. Just to remind you about the general revenue numbers that came out of that, and I know there's some confusion now with the state forecast that took us back to a comparison with September, pre-special session. The actions that were carried out by legislature, by you in October, had an overall net increase in revenue of about $189 million between general fund and other fund accounts. That was 168 of that 189 was general fund. So that's what state economists were referring to earlier today, was that $168 million that was built into your 13-15 forecast. Now, of that $168 million in general fund, about $33 million came from adjusting the corporate deposit into the rainy day fund. So we show that down below. We show the three funds, the general fund, the Oregon Health Authority Fund, of which was vast majority of cigarette tax went into, and the Rainy Day Fund. So if you sum those up, you would get about $156 million, which would be kind of an all-funds estimate when you're accounting for the puts and takes in all three of those different categories. That gives you a kind of an overall picture. And then, of course, going forward, you can see what we expect in terms of the general fund. And those were the numbers that were built into the forecast that you saw today. One thing to point out is saw that the forecast numbers in the out years was up, and really in terms of the general fund alone, ignoring the health authority fund and the rainy day fund shifts in outer years, is relatively small changes. So the changes that you see in the forecast in the general fund are actually basically driven by economic changes, as opposed to the 13-15 forecast. As we went through the major elements of the bill, Chris went into the details around what those distributional impacts would be, some charts or tables you're familiar with, and Chris will go through those with you, starting with Table 3 in your packet in the research report that addresses a combination of the major personal income tax changes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. And as Paul indicated, I'm just going to touch on a couple of the tables in the report. I'm going to be brief just to try to manage some time to make sure that the CPAs and DOR have enough time to provide their testimony and comment on some of the concerns and issues that they're seeing. The tables, of the seven different tax policies that were adopted, their effective dates are staggering. Some start in, they range from tax year 13 to all the way to tax year 2015. So the distributional tables included in the report all focus on tax year 15 so that we aren't bouncing around tax years for the first year that a policy might take effect. So the frame of reference is always tax year 2015. And the table that we have here is our standard income distribution table that comes out of our tax calculator model. And it provides by the amount of income, by the income class, for all returns and then single returns and joint returns. And so we have the number of returns projected for 2015. And at this point, we're thinking that's just over 1.7 million full year returns. And prior law, their tax liability projection was $6.1 billion. And with the tax policy changes embedded into this table, it's a revenue loss of about $26 million. Now, of the seven policies that were adopted, only four of them really fit into this kind of presentation. So this isn't all of the tax policy impact. Paul just talked about those in tables one and two. The four policies that are incorporated into this distributional table are the non-passive income tax rates, the changes to the additional medical deduction, the changes to the personal exemption credit, and the changes to the earned income tax credit. So in total for tax year 2015, we're estimating a $26 million revenue loss.
but the impact across the income distribution is very different. Now, for those four policies, they really do affect four different kinds of taxpayers. Schedule E affects business owners who actively manage their businesses. The medical deduction primarily affects or only affects people of age 62 or older. The personal exemption credit affects only the higher income filers, and then the earned income credit affects only the lower income filers. So that $26 million revenue loss is made up of different puts and takes, so to speak. And for filers of income less than $40,000 in aggregate, we're expecting a tax reduction or a revenue loss to the general fund. And that is driven by the increase in the earned income tax credit, as well as the changes to the additional medical deduction from a deduction to a subtraction. The filers at this end of the income spectrum tend to not itemize their deductions. They just claim the standard deduction, so they couldn't take advantage of that deduction. Now they'll be able to take advantage of the subtraction and reduce their taxable income by some of their medical expenses. At the other end of the income spectrum, for tax filers above $200,000 or so, there's expected to be a net revenue reduction. And that's driven by the changes to the tax rates for non-passive income. And that's reflected here for the $500,000 over group. It's a revenue loss of $36 million to the state, or a tax cut of $36 million for those filers. For all filers in between those two extremes, roughly $40,000 to a couple hundred thousand dollars of income, there's a net tax increase. And that's primarily driven by the elimination or the cutoff for the personal exemption credit at $100,000 for single filers and $200,000 for joint filers, as well as the change in the medical deduction. These folks, basically, their medical deduction is being reduced or eliminated due to the phase-out of the additional medical subtraction. And so just this table takes on a couple different forms throughout the report, but it's our standard table, and that's what's used to discuss each of the policies individually throughout the report. But this is just those four combined. So the report then moves into a discussion of the Schedule E non-passive income. And I'm going to skip a few here for the sake of time. And then we get to Table 6, which is the same table, but this one is just for the non-passive income. And for that policy alone, in tax year 2015, we're expecting a $91 million revenue loss focused on taxpayers above $100,000 of income. And one interesting thing here, between the single and joint returns, about 80% of the impact is expected on joint returns. So about $78 million of the $91 million revenue loss will be felt by joint returns. Now, before I'm going to move on to Table 7 here, this table is a distribution of total income for the tax filers. Table 7 is also an income distribution table, but it's by the amount of income that is this non-passive income. And Table 7 here, so the categories we're starting at, $0 to $25,000, that is of the net non-passive income for these taxpayers. So in total, for 2015, we're projecting about 148,000 filers will have some form of this income, either a net income or a net loss. And in total, those 148,000 filers will have net non-passive income of about $3.4 billion. But that includes about $1.4 million of revenue loss. And those filers are about 47,000. So if we kick out those filers, there are about 101,000, just over 100,000 filers who have the chance to participate in the program. And as I believe the committee is aware, it is an option for the taxpayers to either participate or not participate in the program on an annual basis. They get to make that decision each year. And you're going to hear some more on the detail of those choices from the CPAs coming up. So of those $100,000 that we project could participate in the program, we're thinking only about 78,000 of them will participate in the program. And the driver behind that is the policy decisions around personal deductions, the Schedule A deductions. To participate in the program, the net non-passive income will be subject to the lower rates, but the personal deductions will not be allowed against that income. So, for example, if you have a tax filer whose total income is $60,000 and all of that income is net non-passive income, and they have $20,000 of personal deductions, their choice will be to tax that $60,000 at the 7% rate, which would be a gross tax of about $4,200, and that would be an opt-in version, or they could opt out of the program and have their $60,000 reduced by the $20,000 of personal deductions and taxed in the traditional manner. And in that case, their gross tax would be about $3,100. So in that case, they would opt not to participate in the program. So a couple things to point out about this table. Of the 78,000, 43 or 44,000 of them have eligible income in the 0 to 25,000 category. So that's about 56% of the filers. And then moving right on the table, they have about $400 million of that income. So it's about 8.7% of the income, and they make up 7% of the revenue loss of the tax impact. And going down to the other extreme, we have about 250 filers who would participate. So that's about 0.3% of the participants. They are projected to have just over 12% of the income and also about 12% of the revenue loss. So there are two different views. Both of these distribution tables are helpful in terms of understanding how much income of this eligible income is within the system, as well as the total overall impact across the total income distribution. And then just this chart is a projection of the amount of income that would be subject to these rates. We have some historical information for 2005 through 2010, and we can see the impact that the Great Recession had on that income. It fell from about $4.6 billion to $3.4 billion over the course of 2 years, and it's projected to grow from 11 to 14 by about 6%, and then jump in 2015, and then have an average growth rate of about 7.4%. So we expect it to grow faster after implementation in 2015. And then the report moves on to the additional medical deduction. This is a chart that just shows the red and the blue show the caps under the new policy, and the green line is the average deduction that was taken under the old policy. And the reduction there is where the revenue gain comes from. And that green line is the average deduction taken in tax years 2009 through 2011. Chart 3 is just the projected prior law revenue impact of the provision. That blue law shows a growth rate that is greater than the general fund, and that was projected out through 2023. And the red dashed line is the projection under the current law. Table 9 is the same income distribution table. In net, we expect a $50 million revenue gain in 2015. There's a slight revenue loss for filers under $40,000, and again, I touched on that. Those are the standard deduction filers, and then the revenue gain or the tax increase on higher income filers. And then to start to wrap up, the paper moves on to the personal exemption credit. This is just a chart that shows the prior law and the phase down of the exemption credit. That's the red line. And then the cliff, which is the blue line, blue dashed line. And then we get to table 10, which is the personal exemption credit. The standard table, I just grouped the lower income categories because they weren't affected by that elimination. And then the earned income credit, again, the same kind of table. It just doesn't have the higher income groups are collapsed into one category. And then we get to the tax brackets, and this just shows the change in the 7.6% bracket from greater than $10 million to greater than $1 million. And then here's a distribution table by industrial sector. We expect about 700 corporations to be affected by that tax rate bracket change. And then there's just a discussion of the IC disk, and then a table of the cigarette tax rates, and how Oregon would compare to the other states in terms of our tax rate. If none of the other states changed their tax rate, we would basically increase from 29th to 27th in terms of the state tax rate. So that's a very quick run-through of the report. you have any questions or if you want to look at it later and contact us later with questions.
In New York.
Thank you, Chris. This is excellent. Why don't we move on to our next panel then?
Could I just ask a quick question
yes,
while
please.
We still got Chris here? Thanks a lot. So, Chris, I know I'm sure the CPAs will talk about this too, but in terms of the small business tax cut, how did you determine how many filers are going to configure themselves to be able to take advantage of that? I know that we're still in the early stages of, you know, law firms and whoever putting information out to clients about reconfiguring so they could benefit from it. But
Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, this is what we refer to as a static estimate. So we have one of our core tools is a micro-simulation model of the personal income tax system. And so without getting too much into the nuts and bolts of it, I had to go back to DOR and through electronically filed returns, a subset of returns, we're able to look at the Schedule E, a certain box on the Schedule E, and found out that these taxpayers claim non-passive income. So, in short, took that information, extrapolated from that, and applied that to the sample that I use for the tax calculator. And within that, I came up with a group of taxpayers that have this kind of income. And what the model basically does is calculate taxes. And it adjusts every year for all the parameters, you know, the change in the brackets over the years, for all of the tax law changes. Those are incorporated into this, into the model that I use. And basically, I went through and calculated taxes under the normal system, if you will. And then I tacked on this rate structure. So for the taxpayers that had this income, calculated their taxes twice, so under the normal system. And then if this income were siphoned off and taxed at these lower tax rates, and then all of their other income was subject to the normal system, where the personal deductions were allowed against that income. And then I calculate those two tax amounts, and if the participation gross tax is less than the standard gross tax, then they participate in the program. Mm-hmm. So the number of 148,000 comes from growing the sample to tax year 2015 and projecting, well, about 150,000 filers have this kind of income. Now, that's not necessarily 150,000 businesses, because one business can go to two partners or three partners or any partners, and any one taxpayer can have more than one business. So this is a bottom line net non-passive income for the taxpayer. And so once I had that.
And follow up. So, but in other words, you didn't assume any changes in current filing status to take advantage of this. I mean, aren't you assuming that some entities are going to change the way they file and if they benefit from it?
Yes, we spent a lot of time going over that. And within the model, I could run it a couple of different ways and expand that to other other types of businesses. I could expand it to sole proprietors and spend some time talking to CPAs about how easy it is to shift from a sole proprietor to a pass-through entity and those kinds of things. And the bottom line is there were and there still are a lot of uncertainty and unknowns about how many taxpayers would do that or not. And we didn't have any really solid information to say, well, we think X percent of them will switch over. It was kind of ran it in extremes where none of them or all of them. And to the extent to try and convey that uncertainty, the legislature did include a corrective mechanism where the rate can change in 2019 and 2023, and that's where that came from, about the uncertainty about the potential behavioral response. A lot of the tax policies, some of them can have stronger or weaker behavioral responses, and this has the potential to have a lot of behavioral response.
Right. And okay. Maybe the CPAs that we're about to hear from will be able to shed some light.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Thank you. Chris, following up on that, obviously you and I ran a lot of scenarios,
yes.
And Senator Boquist, and when we originally proposed the entire small business tax cut, it was supposed to be applied to C filers, F filers, and E filers, and all E filers. And so, obviously, the governor wanted some of these sideboards, including just E filers and then just non-passive, and so we accepted those restrictions based on that. One of the things that we, in conversations with the governor's office, who requested those narrowing of it, is that we discuss the idea was is that you would have people who are current sole proprietors, and they would simply move over to be S-Corps or LLCs. And that was acceptable in the model because of the fact that what they want to do is get rid of people who just had who were just C-filers, call themselves sole proprietorships so they can get some tax deduction, even though they weren't running legitimate businesses. So that was the discussion. Question, though, is it seems like to me that if you were able to get this information on Schedule E filers, could you go and do the same thing on Schedule C and F filers, and then anybody who would have a tax cut could make a prediction on what the governor expected people to move over to Schedule E based on that. I mean, obviously, you would do a calculation saying setting up an LLC or an S corp is $1,000 or $1,500. You know what the threshold would be. Could we do that by going into the Schedule C and F filers who have businesses and say, is it worth it to you to transfer and then extrapolate that way? Because, I mean, that's kind of what our conversations with the governor's office was, is that we knew that would happen, but predicting that is based on how much of a benefit the person gets versus the startup costs of an S corp or an LLC.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair George, yes, I have run simulations where I extended to the C filers and the F filers. That's only part of the story about whether or not they would switch. It depends on their personal circumstances, the costs, whatever costs there might be involved in switching, and I think that's some of the information you'll hear from the CPAs. And we didn't really have any good information. I could say, well, if everybody switched, then the total impact would be this. But a lot of the Schedule C filers, a lot of issues start to enter into. You have hobby businesses, and a lot of Schedule C filers who don't have employees, who typically wouldn't be able to switch over because of some of the sideboards included in the bill. So then that raises the question of, okay, if you have a sole proprietor, how many of them is it worth it to them to hire somebody to switch over and now take advantage of it? And we get so far down the path of potential behavioral responses that you can get into a situation of kind of a compounding error as well. If you assume this, and then this, and then this, and then this, and this. And it gets really tricky and complicated to explain about all of the assumptions, the compounding assumptions that were made in those estimates.
I think one of the difficulty things was that the sideboards that were put in were meant to limit those to legitimate businesses that were big and growing, you know, I mean, that were going to be growing businesses. And so I understand why they were put in. Those were fairly negotiated. But one of the things that's interesting about it is that we knew that there would be some moving over, and it's what the threshold is before they'll move over from Schedule C or Schedule F over. And obviously F's more difficult because they have a different depreciation schedule than C's or E's. And so it seems like to me we could create a model, especially on the C filers, but we probably don't have employment information on those folks.
That's correct, Vice Chair. Okay. And that's where I could do it for part of the situation, but so many of the other unknowns are external to the model that I have. And the model I have is basically a statistical model. And so it gets really difficult to take this qualitative information and then assume it that it applies to these and not those filers. Gotcha. In terms of the overall forecast, getting to 2015 and later, trying to get at potential behavioral response somehow is the growth rate in that income. And beginning in 2015 and later, the growth rate in this income is higher than the growth rate in 2011 to 2014. That's a simple way to try and address that without getting bogged down in all of the detail. And what that implies is that over time, as it becomes established and people become more familiar with it and CPAs get used to filing the returns, because nobody's filed this return yet. DOR is still working on how to implement it. Nobody's going to file this return for a couple of years, so there's going to be a lag before we see the real effects.
Thank you. Okay, thanks, Chris. We're going to bring the CPAs up now and see if we can drill down on some of these on-the-ground questions.
Well, yeah,
there's
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for allowing us to speak today. we've been asked to discuss
Would you give
the,
your name, please?
I'm sorry. My name is Doug Henney. I'm a CPA. I've been one for 35 years. I work entirely in taxes. I'm the head of a tax department of about a 20-person CPA firm. And I guess I could say a lot of things about what I've done in the past, but I've worked with the legislature for at least 30 years on various tax issues through the, and we're here, Bob and I are here representing the Oregon Society of CPAs.
Yeah, and thank you very, very much for being here. I know
thank
that you had to come twice because of our schedule, and we really appreciate it.
Thank you. We've been asked to talk about the House Bill 3601 and the implementation issues. As we went through there, we were looking for things that we thought might benefit from some legislative clarification, and we threw in some. We have a report which on the screen, and there's also some things in there just talking about things that will give tax preparers and clients and Department of Revenue heartburn as we're preparing the tax returns starting for the 2015 returns. So let me introduce Bob Karras, and I'll let him do the rest of his introduction.
Thanks, sir. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Karras. I'm a CPA from Happy Valley, Oregon, and also here on behalf of the Oregon Society of CPAs. Let's just take a look at some of the things that we brainstormed. You know, the CPA Society, a few members of our group, put our heads together and said, well, all right, well, if someone were to ask us, what do we see as issues that practitioners and taxpayers are going to face when they try to implement these laws, file returns under these laws? What kind of situations are we going to encounter? So we're not really thinking about, you know, the happy side. The happy side is, hey, you know, I'm going to save taxes. We're thinking about, you know, well, nuts and bolts. You know, what kind of roadblocks, what kind of issues are we going to encounter? So, you know, it's focused on the dismal science of taxation. So the first thing in our outline here is that the differences between the definition of passive activity that is established under the statute versus the federal definition. We see that in the law that in the Oregon law that it's patterned after the idea of when a person is eligible for this rate, he or she is going to be actively involved in a Schedule E business, either a partnership or an S corporation. But we don't want to bring in people that aren't actively involved. But because of the way the Oregon law is framed, it's got to be a little bit more specific, and it requires one more definitional item, which is that the person has to be actively involved. So not only do we have, so now we have a taxpayer who's coming to us, and we know that here's all of the different schedule activities that they report on. And they are non-passive. They are active with respect to a certain number of those on their federal return. Now we're going to have to stop and ask a few more questions and distinguish between whether or not those activities are non-passive under the Oregon law and therefore qualify for the 7% tax rate. So that creates difficulties for the tax practitioner, for the taxpayer as well, and also for the people that program our tax software. I mean, we've gotten to the point where no one's doing tax returns with a pencil any longer. So we have some programming and compliance issues. There's also an issue regarding verification of facts. The statute calls for verification of facts, and there is an item here in the outline towards the end, which we don't need to jump down to, but basically, I'll just summarize it for you, that of course, there's no doubt that the Department of Revenue is going to want to make sure the taxpayers who claim the 7% tax rate are indeed qualified to do so. The potential for abuse exists whenever there's a special provision introduced. We see that on the federal side with the earned income credit, and more currently with the the credit for new home purchases. There was a tremendous amount of abuse of that. So the department is obviously going to want to be militant to protect the treasury, the state treasury against abuse, and is going to need to be auditing those kinds of taxpayers claiming those types of issues. The next item in the outline regards the election, and Chris touched on this. This election requires us now, and requires us now to calculate the Oregon tax twice, because the taxpayer might be better off not claiming that better tax rate on this eligible income. The 7% rate on the eligible income might be better off just going with the regular 9% calculation on the taxable income. So now we have to look at the taxpayer's Oregon tax return twice and decide which way is better to do it, and then decide to do that. This is going to be an issue that's going to come up at the very last minute. This is not going to be something you're going to be able to take into account and plan for, because you're not going to know all the facts until the return is ultimately distilled down to a signable state. So maybe even on the extension, we're going to wind up having, I'm probably going to assume that my clients are paying the higher tax in order to prevent penalties and interest from applying and leave a little bit of money on the table on April 15th, because we know that most of the people that are involved in a calculation like this, they're going to wind up with they're going to wind up extending anyway, and then we're going to wind up hopefully getting a refund based on their eligibility to claim some of that income at 7%. And then the third point, last but not least, I suppose, about this whole thing is that this election is irrevocable. And so if subsequent to the filing of the return, we've made the election, we've decided, yes, we're going to elect to not take advantage of the 7% rate, because overall we're paying less tax if we don't bother claiming the 7% rate on the eligible income. And then after the fact, an audit comes up or an amended return comes up, and we wind up kicking ourselves because we should have made that election. We're not going to be able to go back and change that. And I wouldn't suggest that we should. But the point is that that's another issue, and we advisors are always thinking twice about malpractice, about errors and omissions, because had we known, you know, hindsight's always 20/20, and the lawyers love to think that we have that kind of hindsight, but in fact that's not always going to be available.
Let me talk quickly about a couple of other items that are on our outline. One is, this lower rate applies to any business that you're materially involved in. The complication is, what is the business? Is the business a specific entity? Is it a group of related entities? And for a lot of reasons, taxpayers will split their business into maybe put all your real estate, each one in a separate LLC, for example. Maybe if you have multiple restaurants, you might want to put each restaurant in a separate LLC. So the determination of what is the business that this qualifies for is going to be difficult to determine, especially with the extra rules that have been put in place with regard to making sure that the taxpayer is materially involved. That doesn't seem to include the spouse, but for federal rules, the spouse, if one spouse is materially participating, both of them are deemed to be materially participating. And the thing about the multiple entities, multiple related businesses, let's say, is that we have what's called a grouping election, where for the federal return, we can choose to group them in a certain fashion, say that these are materially involved because they're all interrelated, and these are not businesses we're materially involved in. And I'm not really sure from the legislation how the determination will be made as far as the grouping or lack thereof of various businesses and entities is going to apply. Is it going to be based upon your federal grouping, which might have entirely different issues at stake, versus this. So that seems to me like a legislative, something you might want to at least think about. And there's some other issues by somewhat disconnecting from the federal rule. For example, one of the federal rules is that if you're materially involved in a business, and for example, my CPA practice, I've been working there for 28 years. Well, for the federal rules, if I retire, that business is not treated as material, or excuse me, continues to be treated as material for 5 years afterwards. Whereas this rule here seems to indicate that I each and every year need to be materially participating, and that's just I'm not sure what answer was intended, but it would be nice to have some legislative clarification on that particular issue. And there are a couple other issues like that that would be nice to have some more clarification, or maybe even a bit closer of a tie to the federal rules.
All right. At the top of the next page, the second page, we talk a little bit briefly about the concept of Section 1231 gains. One of the issues that we dug out as we went through the statute was that obviously the law says that capital gains aren't eligible for the 7% tax rate, but there are gains from the sales of business assets, which are called Section 1231 gains, and they are treated as capital gains. So even though they're not a capital gain themselves, they act like a capital gain when they hit the taxpayer's tax return. So we thought that it would be important to at least present the issue, the question, in front of the legislature and ask whether or not clarification is needed. Because what I think would happen is that a taxpayer and their representative would want to argue that these Section 1231 gains, because they're not capital gains, they are eligible for the section for the separate 7% treatment, and the Department of Revenue might feel exactly the opposite. They might say, "No, wait a second, these are capital gains," and so we wind up going to tax court over it. And who knows what the tax court is going to come up with if the legislature gets a bad answer from the tax court? Then that's going to be something that they haven't anticipated. And of course, we can tweak the rates, or we can pass additional clarifying legislation, but it's just something to think about. I'm going to skip the next bullet point.
Let me stop you there for a second.
Yes, ma'am.
Because I'm afraid I might lose this question. On the capital gains issue, the reason people would want them treated as capital gains would be because of the favorable treatment at the federal level. Would there be a problem defining it as capital gains, or treating it as capital gains at the federal level and treating it as something eligible for this at the state level?
No, there would be no problem with that. But I'm just pointing out, I suppose, or we're just pointing out, mm-hmm. that there's a bit of ambiguity that I think that taxpayers will want to drive a wedge into. In other words, if it wasn't intended, and I don't know what the legislature's intent was, but if it was intended that the sales of a business asset should be eligible for the 7% rate, then I think the taxpayers are going to be fine with that. But it's not clear in the statute whether the sales of a business asset are eligible. And if that's not the legislative intent, taxpayers are going to want to exploit that, and then we're going to wind up having some commentary. But the taxpayer is going to have to treat those gains on the sale of business assets above and beyond a certain limit as capital gains, whether they want to or not, on their federal return. That's just the law. It's just you go through this incredibly complex series of pipelines, and out pops a capital gain. But part of that capital gain is consisting of the sales of stocks and bonds, and part of that capital gain is also consisting of the sales on profitability on the sales of business assets. Those two components of capital gain may be taxed differently under Oregon law. They may not be. So we're going to need to think about how that's supposed to work. And obviously, taxpayers and their advisors are going to want to go with, yes, the 1231 gains are not truly capital gains and therefore are eligible for the 7%. And this is a big number, too, because generally speaking, you know, the operating profit from a business may not be that significant, but when a person sells their business, they may be able to reap gains on the sale of those business assets that might exceed their year-to-year operating profits. That's a possibility. It isn't always the case.
Okay. Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Madam Chair, let me quickly take a stab at a question which I know is coming shortly, which is what Senator Rosenbaum and Senator George brought up, is the ease or lack thereof of switching a proprietorship or a farm or something to be on a Schedule E, or from maybe getting a C corporation and putting it on a, also making an S election. That's oftentimes quite easy to do. You know, if you have a proprietorship, you just bring in another partner, even a 1 or 2% partner. You know, make your wife a partner, make maybe the manager a partner. It's easy to get there in many cases. A lot of cases, obviously, there are other issues at play. So I don't envy what Chris has been trying to do, because the determination as to the revenue impact of this, that one's would be hard to project.
Other questions? Does that complete your presentation?
I think it ought to. Otherwise, we're not going to leave any time at all for the department. That would be embarrassing.
Mm-hmm. No, they can always come back.
They can.
We don't want to drag you back.
Well,
so,
okay.
I think in the conversations with the chair at different times, the idea was that there are certain definitions in federal law, and we just kind of wanted to make it as simple as possible coming through, but they wanted that there was the desire to have some of those sideboards put in. Could a lot of these things that you're talking about, because I'm going through them, could a lot of these things just be simplified if we just basically copied federal law on those things? I mean, is that clarifying? I think that was the intent, is that once you figured out your federal, that number would pop out on a Schedule E and then would be easily plugged into a 7% rate. I don't think it was meant to be. I don't think those sideboards that were proposed were meant to be complex or in contrary to federal law. Would that solve a lot of these issues as I go through and look at them?
Vice Chair and Madam Chair, yes, indeed, that would be a simplifying way of dealing with it. Whether the revenue impact would be difficult to deal with, I don't know, but I leave that to smarter people. But yes, that would definitely simplify the job. I mean, if all we had to do was just look at our federal return and identify those, we already know under federal law which of those activities are non-passive, which of those are passive, and if the definition was identical between the state and the federal as to that, it would simplify that.
If I could. I think the issue was that we defaulted when it was decided there were certain passive income type things, like maybe perhaps a real estate holding company that's in an mm-hmm. LLC. Why should that be given some kind of preferential treatment? What we're trying to talk to is people who are hiring people. And so I think that was the sideboard that was desired to be put on. And so we saw the line as passive versus non-passive as something that was easily established in state law, in federal law. What came later in kind of the quick negotiations of the special session was putting an additional requirement on there having to do with kind of a 500 hours. It changed it slightly, but it seems like to me that if we kind of go back and say, okay, what are the – we adopt the federal and then put the requirements before – you're not eligible for it unless you do these things, but once you're eligible for it, then we adopt the federal code rather than saying we'll adopt the federal code and then adopt a few more restrictions on top of that. You see what I'm saying? Basically, qualify the person before they opt into the tax rate rather than have them run the tax rate, do the federal, and then put a few more restrictions after that. You can get to the same result, it seems to me.
I would have to give more thought to that. I apologize. I'm not smart enough to get to answer that question on my feet. I understand what you're saying.
Welcome to our
world.
Whether
it would have a difference out in the outcome, I think we could have a very long discussion, but a beer would be necessary.
Yeah. Gotcha.
As you were talking about the process of trying to figure out which is the best scenario for people to file, it reminded me of the something you go through with the alternative minimum tax, because in that case you do two tax calculations, don't you?
Absolutely.
So wouldn't this be kind of like that?
In a way, it would be like that. As a matter of fact, nowadays, under federal law, we have maybe two or three different calculations that we need to go through to ascertain a person's tax liability, maybe four. This is now becoming, Oregon has always been very simple and very straightforward because there was no alternate minimum tax. Many states have adopted an AMT. We didn't have that. That was nice. And now we have a new wrinkle here in Oregon law that's going to require us to think again about other parameters and decisions.
And also, just to clear it up, you mentioned that you can't go ahead and take one declaration and then change it kind of midstream, but the filer would be perfectly able in the next filing year to change.
Well, that's true. Yeah, they could change their facts. I was referring mainly to, with respect to a particular tax return, whether the situation had changed fluidly after the return was filed.
Yeah.
So what were you asking for on that? It was basically protection, if I heard correctly, protection for basically practitioners that if they make a good faith recommendation to a filer, and then circumstances change through an audit or something, but the filer couldn't come back against your guys' malpractice insurance. In essence, what you're saying is we're going to do the best we can with this, but however things change, there is some question of whether your liability insurance would then be responsible for something that you couldn't predict. And if that's what I heard through what you said. Is that an accurate description?
Except for the last part. The liability insurance would cover to the normal extent. But
What I'm saying, though, is that what you're really asking for is if you make a good faith effort as practitioners, that we as a policymaker don't want to make you guys responsible for looking into the future into a crystal ball. And that's kind of what we're talking about.
That was the issue, yes.
That seems rational.
Yeah, it's just something that we face all the time.
I got you.
Yeah.
We can cram up a form where the filer checks a box that they understand that situations can change.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. It's been very helpful.
Thank you.
I don't see anybody banging at the door, so shall we bring up revenue?
No, I don't know.
Another committee coming in?
The task force.
Thank you so much for coming
down. Thank you very much.
And we would like to continue reaching out to you offline as we struggle with some of these
issues. Excellent. We'd be happy to be available.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Deanna Mack. I'm with the Department of Revenue, and I will make this as brief as possible. Many of the same concerns the CPAs just pointed out to you about the small business tax rate reduction also apply to us. There's a couple of additional ones. One, we're hearing from practitioners that they don't always have payroll information because they use payroll providers to get the payroll, like, you know, Paychex and ADP, those kind of companies. So that there's a little bit of difficulty in getting that information. Also, we wanted to point out that there are some partnerships that are called joint ventures that are husband and wife partnerships. They can elect to file a Schedule C or a Schedule F, and even though they're a partnership, they are deemed under federal law to be a sole proprietorship. So currently, the way we interpret the law, those partnerships would not be eligible for this rate. So if you want to include that, that would be something, a policy choice you would need to look at. Another policy choice that we identified is whether you want the income, as you all know, income for Oregon residents is taxed on a worldwide basis. I mean, anything from any source. So did you intend for the special rate to apply to income from outside of Oregon? Because it is taxed at the regular rate. So right now, the way the statute is written, if all of their income, they meet the other requirements, all their income is from Idaho or California, they'd get the special rate. Of course, the CPA has already mentioned the complex issues about grouping and those kinds of things. So that's the policy issues about the Schedule E piece for you. There's some technical issues with the bill that are just drafting technicalities. We've talked with LRO and LC about them. I'll go over them really briefly. In the special medical subtraction, we tie to Section 213, Paragraph A, which is just the authorization of the deduction at the federal level. It doesn't actually tie to the definition of medical expenses, which I think is where you were trying to get to. So we need to clean up there, delete the A. There's also...
Wait. Go run that by again.
I know I'm talking fast. I'm sorry.
No, we appreciate your effort to keep it brief. But
in Section 213A... Mm-hmm. Just authorizes the deduction under federal law for the medical on your Schedule A. And it limits it to 10% of your adjusted gross income. And so what we did was we tied to that paragraph rather than the entire section of law, of federal law, and we want to tie to the entire section of federal law because it
would
deals
have
with...
What effect? What would the effect be?
Madam Chair, there wouldn't be any effect. The IRC reference that's in statute just needs to be changed.
Right.
So we can use the definition.
Okay. It's just a technical error. We assumed, everyone assumed it tied to the entire statute. It just narrowed it a little bit. There's also another error in the limitation, the means test. It goes up to, if the income is less than $200,000 and then if the income exceeds $200,000, but there's kind of a no man's land for someone who has exactly $200,000 in income. It's an error that we try to avoid, but it was a special session. For the special medical subtraction, that's about it. The IC-DISC legislation, there's probably some clarification that needs to be done there because the way it's drafted now, it does seem that the new tax applies to all IC-DISCs, no matter when they were formed, and the deduction only applies to the IC-DISC that were formed before the effective date of the Act. Do not believe that that was what the intention was. I don't recall those conversations being that way. I thought it applied to both. Both sections applied to entities that were formed before the date. So if that's correct, then we need to correct that as well. Yep. Right now, we're busy working in our tobacco program on implementing the floor tax for the tobacco, the 13-cent increase, and getting new stamps out. So we haven't had a whole lot of time to look at the expiration provisions of the new stamp, but we're thinking that there's going to be some issues with them, specifically because the stamps don't have an amount on them. They're valued at $1.31, but they don't have an amount. And so that might be a problem. It's also unclear whether... whether there's going to be issues for retailers if they are going to have a lot of inventory at the end of the period. So we want to raise the issue that this is something we're starting to look at. We hope we'll have some time before February to actually reach out to retailers and figure out what we can do in lieu of that floor tax, which is what this was trying to accomplish for those one penny increases. The other issue with the tobacco program is the distribution formula. There's a clerical error in the drafting that causes our accountants some headaches. And so I've talked with LRO and LC. They understand, agree, and so we need to make a fix there, make sure that the funding goes to the appropriate places. The last issue that we found in there, and again, this is just, special session kind of issues, is generally when you guys make a law that's retroactive, you also allow a penalty and interest waiver because of those retroactive provisions. And it's usually only specific to that year. There's applicability provisions, but in this particular case, there is no applicability provision. So while we think it applies only to 2013, there's nothing that says that it doesn't apply to all years. So you'd want to clarify that for us if you intend it to only be 2013. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of it in...
Well, appreciate it. Sorry we had to limit you on time. This will be a conversation that will continue. There's probably some of them that will have to wait for a bigger discussion, but it sounds to me like some of these we could easily deal with in the short session. Yeah. Especially if our vice chair cooperates here.
Me?
All right. Thank you very much. Other questions before we go? Okay, looks like we're done. Chris, any party words? Nope. We are adjourned.